Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Greetings and welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? This will be the third part of my interview with Jenny Ashford on her book, The Unseen Hand, which is all about poltergeists and such. I highly recommend checking it out. In this part, we're going to be dealing with violent poltergeists. We're going to talk about the Bell Witch, exorcisms, some very demonic seeming issues. We're going to discuss the Warrens and a few other things. So I hope you enjoy it. And if you want to support the show, of course, become a Patreon for $3 a month at wheredidtheroadgo.com. There's also merch. There are shirts and stuff. I put them up this week with Jeff Ritzman's designs. Tim's design with the card, the burning card, is going to be up as well on the TeePublic site that we're using now because it's a little bit cheaper and the quality is very, very good. So, you can find that if you go to the website and just click on store. There's also notebooks and backpacks and, I don't know, all kinds of stuff, merchandise you can get the different designs on. All right. With no further ado, here's my third part of my conversation with Jenny Ashford. And for the third time, we welcome back Jenny Ashford to the show, and we're going to talk a little more about her book, The Unseen Hand, because there's a lot of really interesting stuff in here. And we're up to the part on violent poltergeists.
Yeah, getting to the good stuff.
And let's talk about one of the more famous ones, the Bell Witch.
Yeah, this is really probably one of the most famous American haunting stories, you know, in all of the annals of paranormal literature. And again, I think this one kind of has a little bit of personal significance for me because my grandmother and grandfather were from Tennessee, and they were from very near where the Bell Witch story supposedly happened, and they had a couple little books about it, and they'd heard about it throughout their childhood and whatnot. So I kind of grew up hearing stories about the Bell Witch. Now, even though it's called the Bell Witch, I hesitate to call it a witch or call it a ghost even. Although, you know, it's in my book about poltergeists, so obviously I think it probably had an aspect of a poltergeist infestation. But even though it had some unusual aspects, and in one sense it was very long-lived, it went on for a very long time, and actually it's still ongoing, not at the same house, but it's apparently still ongoing.
Really?
So they say, at the cave anyway, because the farm where it initially started is no longer there, but they do think that the cave near the house was where the entity was emanating from.
Right, that's right, okay.
And that if you go there nowadays, you know, there'll still be, you can still hear voices and things like that. Now, it started in 1805, and this is kind of interesting because this kind of harkens back to the Jeff the Talking Mongoose story. The first weird thing that happened in the Bell Witch case, reportedly, was that John Bell, the farmer, again with the farm, he was out looking at his cornfields, and he saw a little creature sitting in between the corn rows. And now, he was a farmer, so he wasn't the kind of guy to be like, you know, he should have recognized any kind of recognizable creature from around there. And he wasn't sure what it was. He said it sort of looked like a dog, but that it had a head like a rabbit. And so he thought it was kind of weird, but he shot at it, but missed. And it took off subsequently. Now, after he saw this weird little creature, then all the poltergeist phenomena started. And as with a lot of poltergeist cases, it started with knocking on the walls, usually coming from outside, like beating on the walls of the farmhouse. And then the knocking progressed to a gnawing sound, The Bell children said that they kept hearing this gnawing coming from underneath their beds, and it was upsetting them, and also that their covers would be pulled off and thrown across the room. So then it kind of quickly escalated to the point where the noises and gnawing became a weird whisper. Like, at first you couldn't tell what the whispering was saying, but then it got louder and louder, and then it was, you know, a discernible voice of an old woman's voice. And also at this point, one of the daughters, Betsy, she started having attacks by an unseen force. Her hair would be pulled, or she would have bruises, you know, from being hit and whatnot. And so John Bell, the father, he called some neighbors over because he said there's some weird things going on in the farm. Stay over and see if we can figure out what it is. So they stayed over, and they had the same thing happen to them. Their covers were torn off, and they were hit by invisible hands. And they said they made it go away by praying and things of that nature, because, you know, it was the 1800s. But the longer it went on, the voice started getting louder, and it was just talking and singing, and it was actually able to have conversations. So it seemed like an intelligent entity, whatever it was. And it also seemed to have some bizarre psychic ability. The story goes that it once recited a sermon word for word that was being said across town, like 13 miles away or something like that, that it was saying it at the same time. There is also a story, and this is possibly not true, but this is part of the legend, is that Andrew Jackson came to the farm in 1819, since he had heard about the Bell Witch. It had at this time become quite a famous story. So he evidently wanted to go and stay at the farm and see what was happening. So he gets there, and he was riding in a wagon with himself and his men. And the wagon stopped in front of a little way from the house, and the horses would not budge. They wouldn't go any closer to the farmhouse. And Andrew Jackson said, oh, well, that must be the Bell Witch doing that. The horses won't go any closer to the house. And then evidently everyone present heard a female voice saying, yes, that it was indeed the Bell Witch, and that she would be seeing them later on. And evidently she made good on her promise, because later on in the night, one of Andrew Jackson's men allegedly and unwisely said that he had a pistol and it had a silver bullet and he could kill anything with it, supernatural or not, at which point the entity kicked him in the butt and just kicked him out the door and began sticking him with needles and things of that nature. So this was apparently a really violent, and I mean, pretty much anyone who came into with the exception of the matriarch of the family, who seemed to have avoided most of the spirit's wrath, but pretty much everyone who came to the house would get beat on or would get taunted or something like that. But for some reason, the Bell Witch really, really hated John Bell. She claimed on more than one occasion that it was because in life she had been a witch named Kate Batts, and she had been basically screwed over by John Bell in some kind of a land deal, or she felt like he had cheated her in some fashion. So she said that she was tormenting him now from beyond the grave. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but that's what she said. And John Bell was not in good health his entire life. He had various problems. He had Bell's palsy, which it was not named after him, but
ironically,
ironically, it was not. So he couldn't really swallow, and he was bedridden a lot of the time. And evidently, the entity, the Bell Witch, she just loved that. She would poke him while he was in bed, and she would laugh at him and taunt him and stuff like that. in 1820, when he died, she said that she was the one who had killed him. Now, the story goes that the family found this little bottle of some black fluid near the bed, and they smelled it on his lips. And one of the sons evidently gave some of this liquid to the family cat, and the cat dropped dead immediately. So after which the Bellwitch said, yeah, I poisoned him. And evidently witnesses said even at John Bell's funeral, they could all hear this voice that she was taunting him. She was happy she had killed him. She was happy he was dead or whatever. So she also kind of messed with the daughter, Betsy, who was engaged to a man named Joshua Gardner. And for some reason, the Bellwitch did not want Betsy to marry Joshua Gardner. So she kept harassing them until finally Betsy gave up and said, okay, I'll break up with him, whatever. I don't know what the problem is. So they eventually did break up and she ended up marrying someone else. So after John Bell died, the manifestations kind of waned a little. But the Bellwitch did tell Lucy, the mother, that she's like, well, I'm going away now, but I'll be back in 7 years. And according to witnesses, the witch was gone for 7 years. But 7 years later, she did come back. But she was a lot more chill when she came back the second time. She wasn't really beating on anybody or anything like that. She was just kind of talking to the family members. And apparently she predicted a few things about the world wars and whatnot. And she was there for 3 weeks and then she disappeared again. Now, at the end of the second visit, she said, I'll be back in 107 years. I'm going to visit John Bell's direct descendant, whoever that may be, in 107 years. Now, this is where it gets a little murky because John Bell's descendant in 107 years was Charles Bailey Bell. Now, he never claimed to have had any encounter with the Bellwitch, although he did write a book about her in 1934, but he never claimed that he had seen her. So the farm is gone now, but there is a cave nearby, and this cave, apparently you can still visit it. They still do ghost tours and whatnot. And it's said that back in the old days, you know, one of the daughters, Betsy, she had encountered the entity inside this cave, that she had actually seen her and heard her laughing in there. So some people think that this cave was either where the Bellwitch went to after the farm was gone, or that was where she always lived, quote unquote. And she was just coming to the farm because that was the nearest thing. But a lot of people who have gone to the cave in recent years said they've heard footsteps in there. They hear laughing in there. A few of them said that they've seen an apparition, like a white mist or something like that. Now, here's the thing about it, though, is that there is a lot of conflicting information about how much of this story is true, because most of the details of the original story with John Bell and everything like that didn't really come out until about 70 years after he was dead. So it's possible that someone either took an existing legend around the area or completely made up a story out of whole cloth, and it just kind of, you know, gathered steam and sort of snowballed, and now everyone thinks it's real. But, you know, there are those that say, no, it's been a long time. I mean, like I said, my grandparents were from there, and they said, no, we've heard that since the early 20th century when they were young. So again, it's kind of a thing where, and this is such an unusual case too, if it happened the way it's supposed to have happened, because it really does seem more like a spirit than a poltergeist, even though a lot of the manifestations were very poltergeist-like.
Right.
With the hitting and the knocking and, you know, the covers being torn off and things like that. But the whole thing with the voice and the woman saying that she, you know, killed John Bell and things like that, it kind of makes it one of those weird, ambiguous gray area kind of cases where it could be poltergeist, could be ghost, you know, could be neither of those things, could be both of those things.
But, right.
Yeah, it's this is one of those ones that's just right on the line there.
Let's look at Eleanor Zugin.
Okay. This one, she was, this was from 1925. And she was actually from Romania. She was from a real small family. And she was just turning 12 years old. And all of a sudden, all these strange phenomena started. And it happened first, she lived with her grandparents at the time. And, you know, as soon as she went to live with her grandparents, this stuff started. The first thing that happened was that the outside of the house was subjected to rains of stones and bricks, which kind of came flying at the house and broke all the windows and things like that. Now, because this was a very small town in Romania, the grandparents assumed that Eleanor was possessed by the devil.
Right.
Because, you know, as soon as this little kid turned up at their house, all these stones started flying at the house. So they just thought that she was possessed. And Eleanor herself also seemed to believe this. She actually had a name for her demon. She called it Dracu. And so that kind of shows that she sort of internalized everything about what her grandparents were thinking was causing this. Now, the village was a small one, and, you know, it was kind of getting around. The grandparents didn't really want to keep her anymore because they thought she was possessed, so they sent her to live with some neighbors of theirs. And she kind of got passed around from hand to hand because at this point everyone was afraid of her. Eventually she got sent back to her parents' house, but then her father alleges that he was assaulted by a bunch of potatoes which came flying at him from underneath a bed. So at this stage, Eleanor was taken to a priest. Her father took her to a priest to get an exorcism. And after the exorcism, the manifestations got worse, as they usually do. The priest saw several things breaking, a couple of pots breaking of their own accord, like a heavy dresser moving back and forth, and someone that was there witnessing the exorcism was hit by a plank of wood that came flying out of a corner. You know, they saw a can full of water levitating, things like that. So since the exorcism didn't help and they didn't know what else to do with the kid, so then they sent her to a convent. And these same manifestations happened at the convent. She had a bunch more exorcisms there, and they had a psychiatrist come in and examine her and whatnot. And they really could not find anything the matter with her. They could not see that she was faking anything. They just had no idea. So at this point, since they didn't really know what to make of it, they were like, well, maybe we'll just have to put her in a mental asylum, you know, for her own protection or for the protection of others. They just really didn't know what to do with her.
Yeah.
And it so happened that the phenomena surrounding her had kind of gotten around in the paranormal community. So a psychical researcher named Fritz Grunewald decided that he would essentially adopt her so that he could study her. So he wanted to bring her to Berlin to live with a new family where he could keep an eye on her. Now, it's kind of sad because before that happened, and the little girl was very excited about it because at this point, you know, she'd been passed around all these family members. They all thought she was possessed, and you can imagine how they were probably treating her. So,
yeah,
you know, have this man come and go, oh, we'll come live with this new family in Berlin and it'll be fine and everything like that. So unfortunately, Fritz Grunewald died before he could move her to Berlin. But there was actually a countess in Vienna who was very into the paranormal, and she had heard about Eleanor's case. So she invited Eleanor to come and stay with her in Vienna. And she had a very large house and everything like that. Now, Harry Price, who I think I mentioned in one of the other cases, a pretty famous paranormal researcher, he came and stayed at the Countess's house with Eleanor, and he conducted some experiments on the girl there. And it's kind of good because it was a sort of, I mean, it was a home, but it was a controlled environment. He could kind of keep an eye on everything and make sure no one was faking anything. And evidently, he wrote in his reports that while he was studying Eleanor in the Countess's home, he witnessed many, many instances of paranormal phenomena. He saw things flying across the room. Mirrors and toys breaking spontaneously. And one of the weirdest things he saw was there was, he had some of those magnet letters like people used to keep on their refrigerator. Mm-hmm. And they had them in a box in another room that was locked. And one of these magnetic letters appeared in the air above Eleanor's head and then fell on her head. And there really wasn't any way that it could have gotten there otherwise.
Right.
Yeah. So they're also now, other than this type of thing, the entity or the poltergeist or whatever, it also did things to Eleanor. It would scratch her and leave bite marks on her and things like that. Harry Price was not sure if this was the poltergeist doing it or if the little girl was doing it unconsciously, because he noted that the bite marks were about the same size as the little girl's mouth was. Although he did note that the bites would appear, they would almost go like white almost immediately. Because, you know, when you bite your skin, it kind of turns red all around there and stuff.
Right.
He said go white and raised like almost immediately, which kind of lent him to think that maybe it wasn't her doing it. At some point, they, because of the bites, they placed her under hypnosis. And they wanted to see if they could get the bite marks or words or something to spontaneously appear on her skin. But they were not successful in doing that. And along the way, I think they were kind of trying to get her to rid herself of this notion that she was being haunted by this demon called Dracu, because they thought maybe that was making it worse, or maybe it was making it more violent because she was thinking it was some kind of demonic entity.
Right. Right.
But she really did seem to think it was this demon. She doesn't seem particularly upset by it. I mean, even though it seemed to do some violent things to her, she didn't seem particularly, I mean, she seemed like a pretty happy kid. Everyone that came across her said, you know, it's funny, like, considering how she was brought up and considering all this demon possession and all this other kind of stuff, you'd think that she would be kind of messed up. But they said she wasn't. She was a real happy kid, and she kind of went along with everything, and she was had a real sunny disposition and everything like that. And, you know, she went through all these studies and she didn't complain. And evidently, I think she even would leave, much like they did for Jeff the Mongoose, she would leave little chocolates out for this demon, quote unquote, that was haunting her. So she was just kind of chill with it, which was kind of funny. Now, the interesting thing about her manifestation was that as soon as she got her first period when she was 13, it stopped suddenly. And it did not manifest anymore. And Harry Price wrote a quite a long report about her and all the things that he found when he investigated her. But yeah, after that happened, it just suddenly stopped and never restarted.
Huh. Well, I mean, that argues definitely for some kind of energy being involved one way or another.
Oh, yeah.
Let's talk for a little bit about the Warrens.
Okay.
Early on, one of the first books on, well, probably not one of the first books on the paranormal, one of the books I read when I was a teenager was one of their books, and I came away with kind of a bitter taste in my mouth after reading it. And that has definitely not changed over the years. It seems like they are involved with a lot of things that seem to be hoaxes, like Amityville, which you cover in the book, or cases like The Conjuring, the first Conjuring movie, where, Lorraine Warren was quoted as saying that's exactly how everything happened in real life. And the woman who seemed to be the focus of it said nothing in that movie is how it actually happened in real life.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, they seem to be the prototypical we're in it for the money type of people, and everything to them was demons.
Yeah. They definitely were. I mean, they didn't really do any type of what you would call a parapsychological investigation. They would just pretty much come into a place, you know, Lorraine was supposedly psychic. She would just come in, wave her hands around. Well, you have X amount of ghosts and you have a whole bunch of demons. We need to do an exorcism. And that was kind of the end of it. And then afterward, they would be like, well, we're going to write a book about it, or we're going to, you know, they would do a lecture tour about it. They would sell CDs of their lectures and things like that. So I am kind of, I don't know. It's funny because Tom and I actually did an episode of our podcast about the Warrens. And I said, you know, I've seen interviews with Lorraine Warren. She seems like such a nice lady.
Yes.
So I hate to say that, you know, I hate to give her this sort of thing where she's just this cynical woman who's in it for them. I don't know. I do think that she thinks she's helping people. Hmm. Ed Warren, I'm not so sure about him.
It seemed to be Ed was the one that was coming in and telling people, well, just don't worry about it. Like what was the one story? There were two people who they realized this was not paranormal, and he basically told them to be quiet about it and they can make a lot of money at.
Yeah. And the story that became the haunting in Connecticut, which was the Snedeker haunting. Now, the man who wrote the book that the haunting in Connecticut was based on, Ray Garton, who was a horror writer, he has come forward as saying, one, I never met the family in person. I just listened to tapes that they made. Two, their stories were never consistent. And when I complained to Ed Warren about this, Ed Warren said, don't worry about it. They're crazy. Just make it scary. That's what the writer who wrote the book said.
Wow. So,
yeah, so he's saying that Ed Warren straight up told him it doesn't matter. We're just trying to make a scary book to make money. If it's inconsistent, they're crazy anyway. Just make something up.
Yeah.
That's basically what he told them, according to that writer.
Hmm. And that's not entirely different from what you heard from Enfield, where they said, you know, Ed was like, look, you know, join up with us and we can make a lot of money with this case.
Right, exactly. And similar thing happened with the Amityville case. I mean, the Amityville case, whether that was true or not, I kind of lean toward that being a hoax. But the Warrens definitely did seem to have a nose for, well, we heard about this paranormal case and we think a lot of people will be into this, but we have to kind of sex it up a little bit. So a lot of times they would turn up without being asked.
Yeah.
The Amityville case, I believe they were asked to go there by a different, but not by the family because they had already left at that stage. But, you know, by, I think it was, believe it was by a news crew or someone who was making a show about the house, and they invited the Warrens. But in a lot of cases, I think the Warrens just kind of turn up because they heard about it.
And that was definitely the case with Enfield, and I think it might have been the case with The Conjuring. I think she had said that they just showed up one day. No one invited them.
Yeah, yeah. That is definitely the case there, too. So I definitely think it's kind of a case of Ed Warren having sort of a nose for a money-making opportunity, and him sort of bullying his way in.
Yeah.
Even when he wasn't invited. And it's very funny to me that they made The Conjuring 2 supposedly based on the Enfield case, and Ed and Lorraine Warren are like the main characters.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone who investigated the Enfield case said they turned up one day uninvited, and that's it. You know, it's like they weren't there the whole time.
Yes, and they're busy chastising the actual investigators about taking care of the family. Yeah, you weren't even there, you know? Yeah.
That it is very, and I tend to think too, like you said, they think everything is demons. They wrote a book about a guy who was supposedly a werewolf and things like that. You know, they have their museum and they are trying to make money. I don't begrudge anyone trying to make money. It just seems like they're going about it in a dishonest way.
Yes.
I mean, whether they feel like the end justifies the means. I mean, if they really do believe in demons, and they really do believe that they're helping people get rid of demons, then maybe they feel like, oh, well, it doesn't matter if we lie about it, because the more books we put out, the more stuff we put out about demons, the more people we can kind of win over to our cause. So I'm not entirely sure what their motives are. I just, you know, Lorraine, I don't know, because she seems like a nice person. Ed, I don't think he was honest at all. I think he was pretty much a con man. But to not saying he wasn't a believer, but I definitely think he was kind of a con man.
Yeah. Yeah. That's been my impression, like I said, from the first book I read as a teenager, where I was just like, this is not legit. And it kind of bugs me that in the Conjuring movies, you know, the way they're doing them, it seems like it's more about Ed and Lorraine Warren, and it's pretty much painting them as saints.
Yeah, and that did kind of bother me about. I admit I have not seen the second one that was based on Enfield.
Oh, because it was terrible.
I knew it would just get on my nerves. The first one was all right, but I knew something about the case it was based on, so I was like, this is nothing like.
Yeah,
I thought this case was about. I mean, it's a decent scary movie, but not if you're expecting it to that it's really based on a true story. I'm like, no, it's really not.
And the woman who's written the books about her experiences there said that what they actually went through was worse than what they showed in the movie.
Yes, that's right. I did hear an interview with her talking about that, and she said, yeah, it was a lot worse. I mean, well, the book she wrote about it wasn't it like three volumes?
Yes.
It was like a huge book. Yeah. So she said so much happened there, like over such a long time. I guess they had to compress it, but she didn't seem to complain about it too much.
No,
but she, you know, it's not really what happened, but it was a good movie.
She said there were some interesting synchronicities, like down to things like they got the right wallpaper for the house, even though she never told them what type of wallpaper was in the house, things like that.
Of interesting.
Yeah.
The big details wrong, but the little stuff, they got that spot on.
And they weren't trying, I guess. That was the thing. It just happened.
Yeah, that's very odd.
So let's look at the case of the Black Mausoleum, because this one was really weird.
Yeah, this is a pretty crazy story. Now, this the Black Mausoleum is one particular mausoleum in Greyfriars Kirkyard in Edinburgh, Scotland. Now, this particular tomb belongs to quite a historically reviled figure in Scottish history. He's known as Bloody Mackenzie. His name's actually Sir George Mackenzie. And he died in 1691. While he was alive, he was responsible for about 18,000 deaths. There was a religious persecution in Scotland at the time. It was the Covenanters, and he had a bunch of them killed. And while he was Lord Advocate, you know, the time that he was Lord Advocate, they still refer to it in Scotland as the killing time. So he was responsible for the death of 18,000 people. Now, despite this, there were really no rumors about his tomb being haunted or anything like that until a bizarre happenstance in 1998. Now, the story goes that a homeless man was in Greyfriars Kirkyard, and he was looking, it was storming and things like that. So he was kind of looking for some shelter from the storm. And he decided that this particular tomb was the best place to find it. And it actually is a very beautiful tomb. It's called the Black Mausoleum. It's not exactly black. It's more kind of like a dark gray, but it's a really nice, architecturally very nice. So he decided he was going to break in there and sleep in there or whatever. So he breaks in there and he starts poking around, maybe looking for valuables or something in some of the coffins or whatever. And while he's in there poking around, the floor gives way beneath him and he falls into this sub-basement. Now, according to the story, the sub-basement contained the bodies of plague victims, like it was a mass plague grave that had been put there that everyone had kind of forgotten about because everything had been built over it subsequently.
Yeah.
So he falls through there. There's all these skeletons. She was just like Poltergeist when she fell into the pool, you know what I mean? And all the bodies popping out and everything like that. So he understandably freaks out, runs out of the tomb, runs down the street, runs into a security guard and a dog who were going through the cemetery and is never seen or heard from again. Now, after this happened, supposedly, everyone thinks it must have unleashed something from this tomb, because a day or two after the tomb was broken into, a woman was in the cemetery, a tourist or whatever, and she looked through there's like a little window in the door of the tomb, and she looked through there and she said that she was knocked backwards by a violent blast of cold wind. And they have also, over the ensuing days, they also found a couple people unconscious, like laying in the cemetery right in the vicinity of the tomb. And some of the people said, well, that invisible hands had tried to strangle them. And so this happened two or three times. And then the Edinburgh City Council said, you know, maybe since the tomb got broken into and there's all this weird stuff, apparently they're also finding like some dead animals around the tomb and stuff and other little weird things like that. They said, maybe we should kind of rope it off and not let anybody around it because obviously there's something weird going on. So they kind of made it off limits. Now, there was someone who lived nearby. He was a writer. And he asked the council, his name was Jan Andrew Henderson, and he asked the council, you know, can I do like a controlled ghost tour around the cemetery and let people in to see the tomb? And the council said that would be okay. They said, as long as it's people on the tomb, they can look in there. They can't go in there because it's too dangerous. So they said that people could go if they were part of this official tour. Now, as soon as the official tour around this mausoleum started, that's when the phenomena really started ramping up. And it got kind of violent. So about 200 people have claimed that they blacked out. Some people have claimed that their fingers were broken by some unseen force. Hair pulled, scratched, and then there's minor stuff like cold spots. Some people feel sick or dizzy. They smell funny things, sulfur, things like that. And a lot of them have heard things like animals growling or something like that. And there are also another weird thing too, is that some tourists that have gone on the tour, they said nothing happened to them while they were on the tour. But then stuff happened to them later. Like they would come home and they would be in their hotel room or something like that. And then they'd have all these weird electrical anomalies. And sometimes like burns or scratches would turn up on their skin. They didn't know where they came from. And some of them said that when they got back home, they started having poltergeist activity, little fires breaking out, you know, objects flying around, stuff like that. And the writer that set up the tours initially, Henderson, he said that his own apartment and the office that he used to conduct the tours from eventually burned down.
Yeah.
After, you know, shortly after he had started conducting the tours. But his tour company does keep a record of everyone that complains about these injuries and things like that. And it's since 1998, since the homeless man apparently burst through the floor of this tomb, there have been over 500 claims of injuries and unusual things sustained while by people that were on the tour. And it's also said that whatever is haunting this tomb, a poltergeist or whatever it is, was actually responsible for the death of a person. A man named Colin Grant, who went there in 2000 to do an exorcism at the tomb, was evidently found dead of a heart attack shortly afterward. So his death is sometimes attributed to whatever is in this mausoleum. Now, no one is really sure what this could be. It seems very poltergeist-like.
Right.
In the fact that it's, you know, it sounds, it's hitting, it's pulling hair, it's doing things like that. It's just weird that nothing happened before this homeless man allegedly crashed through the floor. Now, the weird thing about it, too, and, you know, every source has talked about this homeless man crashing through the floor. They never have found that man that I know of. The source for that story was apparently the security guard who saw him terrassing out of the mausoleum. So I'm not sure how much faith I can put in that part of the story, but it does seem like there weren't any reports of unusual activity around this particular tomb until 1998. And this ghost tour started shortly afterward. And then it just kind of blew the doors off. Like there's all this kind of stuff happening. So they don't know if this is actually a poltergeist, if it's the ghost of George Mackenzie and he's mad that someone broke into his tomb, or if it had something to do with all these plague victims that people had forgotten about, like maybe something was unleashed from there. But apparently they're still doing tours in Greyfriars Kirkyard, and you can go see this particular tomb and hopefully not have anything follow you home afterward.
Yeah.
That happens a lot. And some, like I said, some of the injuries people have sustained have been no joke. I mean, some of them have got broken fingers and things of that nature. And that one guy apparently died. So be careful if you go.
One of the things I noticed from a lot of these cases, I mean, exorcisms are a fairly common thing and they rarely work. If anything, they seem to make it worse.
Yeah, they really do seem to. In very, very rare cases, they, you know, something goes away after there's an exorcism. Usually it either has no effect or makes it escalate.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like that might be because if the poltergeist activity is caused by the unconscious actions of the focus, maybe bringing someone in to do an exorcism is almost like validating the exterior nature of whatever this entity is, which gives the person more energy because they think, no, it's a demon. It's outside. They're having people come in and say that it's a demon, so it must be a demon. So
that makes some sense.
It's going to start acting more and more like a demon. It's going to have more and more power because the focus is thinking of it as an outside entity and because other people have come in validating that belief. Maybe that's what it is. I kind of feel like that might be the case.
It's certainly a possibility, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's look at one of these cases. I think the most interesting of the demonic ones in your book was Latoya Ammons.
Yeah.
That was from 2011, so not that long ago.
Yeah, fairly recent. And this actually happened in Gary, Indiana. Latoya Ammons, she had just moved into a house. She moved in with her mother, and she had three kids also who were kind of teen. I think the oldest one was 12. And the first thing they noticed was very similar to Amityville Horror. They noticed that the rooms would kind of fill up with all these black flies. And they would kill them, and then the next day they'd be back again. So they thought it was weird, but not paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
I had a similar thing happen to an old house I lived in. I went in the laundry room one day, and there were just flies all over the window. And I was like, oh my God, Amityville! But then, you know, but after I killed them, they came back one time, and then I killed them again. They didn't come back. But she had that happen. So there were all these black flies. And then they started hearing footsteps around the house and doors opening and closing in the middle of the night when no one was supposed to be up. And then LaToya started seeing like a shadowy figure of a man. And then she started seeing like wet boot prints on the floor, like someone had been walking around. Now, this went on for several months. It was creepy, but it didn't upset them too much, evidently. But then about 4 months after they had moved into the house, LaToya went into her daughter's room, and the daughter was levitating a few feet above the bed.
That's a little unusual.
A little, yeah, it's a little unnerving. So she thought, well, okay, now we need to do something about this. So she called her priest, and her priest came, and they did a cleansed the house with bleach and drew crosses around and whatnot. Now, they also called in some psychics, and the psychics said, this house has 200 demons in it, and you guys should move out. At which point, LaToya was like, well, thank you, but I don't really have the money to move, so we're just going to have to live with it. 200 demons, I'm not sure where they came up with that figure, but, you know, that sounded very Warren-like. And
yes.
You've got all these demons in here. So, you know, she's like, well, I can't move. I don't have the money. She's like, but she did do another cleansing with sage, and she set up, like, a little religious shrine in the basement after the psychics told her. They said maybe that would help. So she did that. And the disturbances went away for a couple of days, but then they started back again, and they were a lot worse. And all three of her kids, there was a 12-year-old, there was a 7-year-old, and a 9-year-old, and they all started acting like they were possessed. They all started talking in funny voices. They started acting aggressively. Their eyeballs were bulging out and rolling back in their heads and things like that. So she takes the kids to their family doctor. The doctor at first said, well, it's like a group delusion. You know, he didn't think there was anything the matter with them other than that. But he did say the more that LaToya kept bringing the kids back, the less he thought that it was delusion. He said that they were just, the way they looked, it was just too, it just wasn't right. I mean, he's like, it didn't look like they were faking or they weren't making anything up. And other nurses and staff around the medical office also said that they saw the 7-year-old son being levitated off the ground and thrown against the wall. And after that, the two boys blacked out and they couldn't wake them up. And they had to call an ambulance. The kids were taken to the hospital. Now, somebody, no one is really sure who, but when someone working at the hospital called Department of Child Services, DCS, at this point, and whoever reported it said that they thought that there might have been some child abuse going on, or that LaToya was making these children act like this because she had some kind of demonic possession delusion and she was kind of making her kids act that way to sort of validate her own delusions. So the DCS assigned someone to come and check out the kids. And the person that was first assigned to the case was named Valerie Washington. And she came out and she said the boys did act possessed. They were growling, their eyes were rolling back in their heads and stuff like that. And they were acting very violently toward each other and toward their family members. The brothers were strangling one another. One of the kids headbutted the grandmother in the stomach. And now the woman from DCS said that she was present when one of the boys grabbed the grandmother's hand and then he walked up the wall and across the ceiling and down the other side. And then he had this really freaky grin on his face the whole time. So he said he walked all the way around the room while he was holding on to his grandmother's hand.
Right.
Yeah. So evidently, like I said, the DCS woman said she said this, and a couple other employees at the clinic said they saw it as well.
Yeah, that's perfectly normal.
Yeah. After this incident, the DCS intervened, and in a very unusual move, they removed all three children from the house without a court order, which they don't usually do unless they feel like the children are in immediate danger. So apparently it was very upsetting. The kids cried and things like that, but they actually separated some of the kids. The boys were sent to one hospital, and I think the daughter was sent to another one. And the hospital where the boys were at, they sent out a chaplain and they wanted to do another exorcism. Now, when the priest came out to do the exorcism, he said that the lights were flickering really weird, like in a supernatural kind of way. Now, he kind of thought that not only was there demon possession going on, but they thought the house might be haunted as well by a ghost. So while this investigation was going on, the woman from DCS came out to the house and because she wanted to check out the condition to see if the children could be returned. Now, some policemen came out too. The police captain said that after he got back from the house, photos he had taken in the house had humanoid silhouettes in them that had not been there when he had taken the pictures. He also said that after he left the house, he had all kinds of electrical malfunctions in both of his cars, his personal car and his police cruiser, like the electric seat wasn't working and all these things were going wacky with it. And the garage door at his house wouldn't open and things like that. So at this stage, they thought, well, I don't think the kids should be returned here. So the two older kids were sent to an orphanage in Chicago. And then the seven-year-old was sent to a psychiatric facility. Now, while he was being examined, most of the doctors at the psychiatric facility thought that probably he wasn't really, quote-unquote, possessed, because he would act possessed when other people were in the room, but when no one else was in the room with him, they would sometimes videotape him, and they said he would act more or less normal. So they didn't think there was anything necessarily wrong with him, but they were under the opinion maybe his mother had encouraged him to act that way. But it did seem, though, that other police and DCS people who were at the house were kind of witnessing some unusual paranormal activity. Also, there was some kind of oily fluid that came out of the walls. And it reappeared even when the room was closed off and no one had been in there, and they couldn't determine the source of that. So they did several other exorcisms. They did another minor exorcism of the house. They did one of LaToya. And the last exorcisms they did, unusually, this actually did seem to stop the phenomena. And the children were eventually returned and acted more or less normal. Now, the family eventually moved out, and another family moved into the house. And the new family that moved in, they didn't really report anything. Now, several years, well, 3 years after the Ammons had left or had moved into the house, Zach Baggins from Ghost Adventures, he bought the house. He was going to make a documentary about the LaToya Ammons house and about the house in general. So he bought the house for $35,000 in 2014, and he was going to make a documentary called The Demon House. Now, what ended up happening with that, though, he supposedly had a bunch of former residents come back, and he was going to interview them and all this other kind of stuff. But he claimed that when he had these older residents come back and interview about the house, that quote-unquote demonic activity restarted. And he said that he was afraid that someone was going to get hurt. So he didn't necessarily decide to shelve the documentary, But in the end, he had the house torn down in 2016 because he thought, according to him, he thought it was too dangerous. So the house has since been torn down on Zach Bagans' authority. And he did film the house being torn down. So evidently that's going to be in the documentary too. Now, I haven't checked lately at the right when I wrote the book, the documentary was still not finished. It's listed on IMDb. And as of February 2nd, 2016, it was supposedly coming soon, but I don't think that it has been finished or come out subsequently. I could be wrong about that. But that was pretty much the end of that story. So whether that was some, like I said, I'm not a believer in demon possession in general. I tend to think that most people that allege that they are possessed by demons are either have a mental illness, or it's misidentified poltergeist activity filtered through people's belief in demons. I could be wrong about that, obviously, but that's kind of my belief. And that was kind of the, you know, that was kind of the frame that I used. And that's why I put so many demon possession cases in the book, you know, where people might not think, well, what does demons have to do with poltergeist? I think that it's the same phenomena. I just think people are interpreting it in a particular way.
Right, right. And according to IMDb, it's still just in production.
See, that's what I thought, yeah.
So it hasn't changed. There's no new information or anything. There's a user review for 1 star that says still waiting.
Where is this? I would actually be interested to see that documentary.
yeah. It might be very good. Yeah. I mean, who knows? So let's get into some explanations for some of this stuff. Now, the book is called, for anyone who's missed it, it's called The Unseen Hand. And there's a lot of different explanations as to what may be going on with poltergeist activities. Let's look at some of the more skeptical or debunking sort of explanations around it.
Yeah, I deliberately put like a pretty big section on this because in a lot of poltergeist cases, there are a lot of things that it could be, you know, before you resort to saying that it's paranormal. I mean, there are a lot of things that can cause the same types of manifestations. I mean, obviously, when you put aside obvious cases of fraud, you know, you're going to get things like, electromagnetic fields, like unusual electromagnetic fields around a particular appliance that's malfunctioning or, you know, house's wiring is malfunctioning. Things like that can cause the feeling of a presence in the room. Mm-hmm. It can cause sort of eyeball vibrations that can maybe make you see things like lights or shadows out of the corners of your eyes, things like that. So, this is why a lot of parapsychologists will check all the EMF readings of the house so they can rule that out because that's not causing that. Infrasound can also cause similar things. And infrasound can actually be produced by appliances, fans, refrigerators. There was actually quite a famous case where there was a man who worked in an office and he kept seeing things in his office and he thought his office was haunted. But it turned out that it was a desk fan that he had that was making a particular sound frequency that he couldn't hear, but it was causing his eyeballs to vibrate at a particular frequency, and it was making him see apparitions out of the corners of his eyes. When he turned the fan off, he didn't see anything anymore.
Yeah, I remember that case.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's also the possibility that something paranormal could be creating an electromagnetic field as well, which is then causing people to see something that's not what is actually the cause of it.
Not what's actually there. Yeah, and that's actually a very good point. It could be some kind of paranormally generated electromagnetic field causing you to see particular things that maybe the paranormal entity itself is not producing directly.
Right. It's something from your subconscious.
Yeah, exactly. But a similar kind of thing can happen with carbon monoxide poisoning. It can cause the same kind of thing. It can cause hallucinations and feelings of oppression and things like that. Also, there are, you know, from Michael Persinger, who's done a lot of work with the God helmet, which is the helmet mm-hmm. that even has all the electrical, and it does electrical stimulation of the brain. And they have been able to, by electrically stimulating particular parts of the brain, they can cause people to feel like there's someone else in the room with them, or that they are temporarily outside of their body, or, you know, things of that nature. So, and
it's similar, but not exact to what people actually right. experience.
Yeah, it's usually not as severe. It's usually like a pretty minor. And I'm not sure if that's because people know that they're being experimented on, because, you know, things like that can be generated naturally, for example, like in an epileptic seizure or something like that, which is another thing that can cause hallucinations and feelings of other people in the room and things like that.
Yep.
You know, there's also a couple people have posited maybe ball lightning, which, you know, that's kind of one of those if and sort of things too. So, you know, like I said, there's a lot of things that can cause those types of manifestations. So that's why I wanted to write this book too, is because I feel like it's really important that when we're studying this type of phenomena, we can't get carried away, you know, because it's so easy for it to be something natural that we're just hoping is paranormal. So I kind of want, you know, I kind of wanted to run down all this stuff. So it's like, okay, can you rule all that out? If you can rule all that out, then maybe we have something. Because I definitely do think that there's something there that needs to be explained. It's just, there's so much stuff that you have to rule out before you can even get to that point.
Absolutely. Yeah. And of course, one of the more popular explanations, the one that you're definitely leaning towards, is that this is created from a unconsciously by a certain person.
Yeah. I tend to think that that's probably what it is. And actually, I feel like Tom came up with the best explanation for this, or the best description of this, because he calls it, you know, from his own poltergeist experiences with the Mammoth Mountain poltergeist. He told me, he said, you know, I think it's like an out of body experience, but it's only of your subconscious. So it seems like a separate entity. He kind of compares it to a split brain patient. You know, sometimes people with severe epilepsy, they'll have a surgery where their corpus callosum is severed. So the two halves of their brain can't really communicate with each other anymore. And they feel like they're kind of two people in one body, or of two minds rather. And one half of the brain could be doing things that the other half is not aware of, and things of that nature. He said, it's kind of like that, but it's with your subconscious. You know, it's almost like your dream self is acting outside of your body without your permission or without your knowledge, really. He said that's what it seemed like to him.
And it almost seems to have a childish sort of thing to it. Like when these things manifest, especially at the beginning, they tend to be very childlike.
Yeah, and that was kind of another thing that makes me lean toward that whole, it's your subconscious self acting out outside of your body, because it's always doing bratty things. It's throwing things. It's smacking the wall. It's setting little fires. It's poking people or biting people. It's like things a little kid would do, you know? And definitely, I mean, and like I said, and Thomas talked about this a lot too, because his Mammoth Mountain case, he said, you know, it did things like, it just moved little towels. Like it would move a towel from one place and then would stick it in your pocket. It would do like little silly things like that.
Right.
Making little smiley faces.
Yes.
Like a little kid would do.
And of course, one of the other possibilities is that although it may be psychokinetic, it might also be something that an actual entity is picking up on and using as fuel.
Yeah, it could be that too. I mean, and it definitely could be. I mean, I definitely do make a distinction between ghost and poltergeist. If a poltergeist is a separate entity, I don't think it's a ghost in the sense of it was once a person that was alive and this is their consciousness that has survived. I think it's probably just some kind of spirit that was never incarnated, let's say. It's maybe some kind of elemental spirit or something like that that's always been in that form. But like I said, I tend to think it's generated by a living person. But if it's a separate entity, I don't think it's an entity that was ever a living person.
I think there might be cases where it could be either, too. Yeah. I mean, obviously, we went through some cases that, definitely seem to have that haunting spirit sort of vibe to it, where that would make more sense. And then other cases where very clearly the unconscious PK makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, like I said, I'm not a parapsychologist. I'm not I've talked to parapsychologists. I interviewed parapsychologists for the book and things like that. But, I'm not saying that it could be one or the other. I mean, even parapsychologists don't know. And there's a lot of gray area between, is this simply an unconscious energy just doing stuff, out of nowhere? Is it intelligent? Is it coming from, some other, is it some kind of psychic, who knows? They don't know. No one knows. But it's kind of a fascinating field of study. And I really think that it should be more looked into in a scientific, skeptical way to get to the bottom of what this really might be.
And of course, there are the people who simply think that these are just all demons.
Yeah, we know who that is. I made a meme of them. I don't know what happened to it, but I made a meme of them and Lorraine Warren. And it's kind of like, you know, the guy from Ancient Aliens that says it's, I'm not saying it's
aliens. Yeah, demon, yeah.
But I made one for them, but it was demon specific.
That's pretty accurate.
Yeah, every single case, pretty much.
Yeah. studying this type of stuff too. I mean, it's like we don't understand. I mean, we have absolutely no idea how this stuff would even work. If it is spontaneous PK, we don't understand how PK works. It's one of those things where in order to understand this, there's a lot more work we have to do in understanding what consciousness is and how it reacts with our environment.
Yeah, we're really not that close to figuring out what the mechanism of it would be, if indeed there is a mechanism. I mean, they don't really study PK in the lab much anymore. I mean, as far as I know, I don't know if there's even one ongoing now. I mean, the last ones they did were those ones with random number generators.
Yeah.
Where they found a slight effect, but, nothing to get super excited about.
Well, that slight effect, though, was very improbable.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
True. So,
Robert Schock's research was kind of interesting, where he talks about how, if you look at all the different psi research done over the last 100 years, you find that during higher solar activity, you had more successful psi research.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting, actually. So it may be something to do with, it's all energy. So anything that causes more energy to be pumped into the environment probably have some kind of effect on that.
And I think initially my thoughts were that he was going to say that there was going to be less, that the sun was somehow interfering with psychic, whatever causes psychic abilities, but instead it seems to be supercharging them.
Yeah.
Which suggests they're not like radio waves. They're something else entirely.
Yeah, yeah. That would be that's really interesting. I have to look more into that because that sounds like a really fascinating line of inquiry there.
Yeah. Well, as he put it, either there's been this long conspiracy to only have good results during high solar activity, or there's something to it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely the case. And actually, it's funny because one of the cases that I wrote, it's in my book, but I also wrote a whole book about it, House of Fire and Whispers, about the Keith Linder case. When they charted a lot of the manifestations later on, they noticed that it only happened during particular moon phases or something like that, or solar phases,
really?
I believe it was. Yeah. So it's interesting that you should mention that, because he did, Steve Mara and the other investigators on the case, when they charted the frequency of the manifestations, they did notice that there was more activity during certain seasons and certain periods of solar activity. So there might actually be something to that.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that was done.
Yeah.
There was something else I was going to say about this. The fact that these poltergeist activity can manipulate matter the way it does. It's not just a matter of moving objects. You have, depending on which cases you want to go with, you have it actually transmuting objects into other things.
Yeah. And moving things immediately, like from one place to another.
Right. And right. So it disappears and reappears somewhere else. And
like instantaneously.
Yeah.
Like no distance was passed. And there's also kind of the weird things, and I think we talked about this on the last show when we were talking about stones, where things make more noise than they should. Things are mm-hmm. warmer than they should be. There's also the case of in some of the cases where rain was coming out of the ceiling and things like that, the rain will dry up immediately and then everything's dry. You know, the walls or the ceiling or wherever the water came out of will instantly be dry. So it's almost like it's not real water. It is, but it appears and disappears just in an instant, and then it just dries out, and there's no residue left behind.
It suggests that there's a lot we don't know about how reality works.
Oh yeah, that's definitely the case. I know that's definitely the case. We're really still, I mean, it's better than it was a couple hundred years ago, I guess, but we're still taking baby steps, I think, because reality is just so much, every new discovery shows it's like so much weirder than we imagined. It just gets weirder the more we learn about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, too, that we're kind of stuck in this reductionist paradigm that's only going to get us so far.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seems to be opening up more and more. Like, science seems to be taking a little bit of a different approach to certain things, and it seems to be, eventually going to go in a bigger direction rather than trying to reduce everything to its parts.
Right, yeah.
Because obviously there's some things that works great with and other things it does not.
Yeah, and I guess, at this stage we're just kind of feeling in the dark because, we're just little evolved creatures on this little planet, and we didn't really, our brains only evolved for our tiny little environment back on that savanna, we didn't really evolve to understand quantum mechanics or anything like that. So, our little brains are just kind of just getting to the point where we're like, well, maybe we can figure this out. It's, I hope we will.
Yeah. Maybe we were never meant to figure it out.
Yeah, that's true too. I hope that's not the case. I hope we do figure it out, because I'm curious.
Well, it doesn't mean we can't figure it out, but it's also, I think it's also a point of, it's like the eyeball trying to see itself directly. You can see your own eyeball in the mirror, but you can never look at it directly.
Yeah, that's true. And you can never see yourself in the mirror with your eyes closed.
Well, that's true. Well,
they might be giants.
What? Where can people get the book?
Well, the easiest place to get it is on Amazon. All my books are on there, and all the paranormal ones are in all three formats: print, ebook, and audiobook. You can also get the audiobook from Audible if that's your thing, but they also have it on Amazon. Amazon's the easiest place to get it.
Okay, and your website?
www.jennyashford.com. And I also have a blog called goddessofhellfire.com. And I occasionally put like movie reviews and stuff like that on. They're usually kind of funny. And I also have a podcast, 13 o'clock podcast, which is kind of weird topics, mysterious type stuff, paranormal, true crime, weird history, that type of stuff. And that's we have a YouTube channel, and it's also on the Project Entertainment Network. That's just the audio version.
Okay. And your next book, you said, is going to be on true crime?
Yes. The next book, it's actually going to be three volumes, I think. But I'm about halfway through the first volume. It's going to be called The Faceless Villain. And it's going to be all about creepy unsolved mysteries or creepy unsolved murders from the 20th century. So the first volume is 1900 through 1959. And then there'll be two more volumes up till the present day.
That sounds really interesting.
It has been. I've been having a great time researching this, actually. I mean, it's creepy and frightening and things like that, that all these kind of crimes happened back then and no one ever figured out who did them. But, it's still kind of fascinating, even though it's horrifying.
It still happens today.
It does, yeah. It does.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, Jenny.
Well, thank you so much for having me on again. I can't believe we got three whole The old parts out of this, out of my little book.
All right, and I'm going to take you out with something kind of disturbing, to some of you anyway. This is a band called Al Batwitch. It's one of Timothy Render's projects. The album is called If Corporations Are People, Why Won't They Die? And this is a track called Mirror Tower. Enjoy.
Wicked Gazer!